Hey, welcome to the Missio Day podcast. Check us out on the web at missiodaychicago.com.
You guys have a seat. Welcome. We are a series called on Overcoming Cynicism, and all of us are prone to this cynical posture after going through life. It's easy just to be a little bit of our hopes. Our hopes are silent. There's moments where we feel like other people have broken their trust with us, so we have this distrusting posture towards God and the people of the church. And so we've been looking at various passages between people from the Old Testament. This week, we get to the way of Jesus, how what Jesus did is he helped us overcome this sense of cynical self-fulfillment that cynicism kind of moves us towards this posture to protect ourselves from hurt, protect ourselves from pain, and fulfill ourselves. And so Jesus, what he wants to do is he wants to fulfill you himself on this morning, and teach you that. And so what Jesus does is he wants to see a self-denial instead of self-fulfillment. If anyone had a right to be cynical, it was definitely Jesus. Jesus had a right to be cynical. If anybody had a right to be cynical, it was him. If you think about it, Jesus had crowds following Jesus. That would follow him for many reasons, but they were often misguided reasons. They thought that he was going to be a political messiah, and he was going to, call down fire on the Samaritans, the disciples instead. Others are angry at him if he didn't heal or pass out the bread to them. And so there was crowds following him for misguided reasons, which could have easily made Jesus for a symbol towards these masses. And he could just stop preaching to them, stop healing them, looking at them like, get out of here, for no reason Jesus would do that. There's also times where Jesus his disciples left. There's passages where he has their 12, even in the middle of John 6, when he teaches a hard teaching, they said, like, this is hard, we couldn't follow this. And so many disciples just fled and left him. His family didn't believe him. His brothers didn't believe him. At one point in Mark 3, it literally says that his family actually went to seize him. They were saying that he was out of his mind. Like, this is Jesus, our brother is guy is just like, he's teaching all kinds of things, saying he's the Son of God. Pharisees publicly harassed him, said, like, he was a demon. They thought he was demon possessed at one time. And so you had all these people, all these reasons Jesus could have grown cynical towards God, but people, his inner circle misunderstood him, even denied him. His father apparently turned his back upon him, right? Imagine the cross, if anybody had a moment to be cynical with Jesus on the cross, like Golgotha, when people mocked him. Poked his beard out of his face, and his moment, the only words, he only had a few words of the cross, and he chose to say, like, Father, forgive them, they don't know what they're doing. He says, my God, why are you forsaken? So even at this moment, we've been sinning towards God for allowing him to die on his cross, sending him, had a purpose in him to die on the cross. He had a right. And so can anyone justify being sinful if Jesus was not a sinner? And I think for us in the room, if you're like me, that you're prone to cynicism, it's always like there, you're fighting against it. There's nothing more message needed than the cross. I think that Jesus' movement towards the cross is what we need more than anything to help us overcome cynicism. And as I was thinking about this, I began to think about a board game that I saw. My wife and I love playing board games. We love playing board games with other couples. Time to get together and have fun. I like the mindless games, sometimes I like the strategy games. But there's one game I saw, and it's called Going to Jerusalem. It's the Parker Brothers came out with this game in the 80s. Here's the pieces right here. So it's Going to Jerusalem. Great board game. And I guess the Parker Brothers kind of dominated the Christian crowd at the time. So you, instead of getting out of the car, go simple, little dog. You get to be a disciple of Jesus in this game. You get to carry a staff and a rod, and you walk around this board game. You move around, you roll the dice, you lose your crown. And then when you get there, you get to pull a card that's got questions. And then you provide a Bible for you, a New Testament to turn the pages in there and find all the answers. And then you can say, look, there's the answer. And then if you can't find it, it's in the back of the Bible, too. Yeah, but for the kids, you know, you move around, so you just battle. I don't know what the things are. Listen, I didn't look that far into it. This is just a good illustration. But it's so funny because I started looking into it. You go through all the different places that Jesus goes through in his gospel. And, you know, you get to the very end, and if you win it, if you play really well, you answer all the questions, and you roll good dice, guess what you get to do at the end? If you win the game, you get to be with Jesus and triumph. That's amazing. Oh, that's so cute. You get to be with Jesus in triumphal entry, and the game's over. That's it. That's the game. And there's no going to the cross, no crucifixion in the game whatsoever. Sadly, if there's no crucifixion, there's no resurrection. And so here's this board game where I can't help but think, as I look at the Bible's game, that many of us, our version of Christianity, our version of following Jesus is like this. That it's sanitized. It's cleaned up. It's a nice discipleship. There's no clearance process. Many of us believe like our temptation of our dead age and our Christianity moment is to have Christianity without the cross. Have a Christian message without the cross. And perhaps that maybe you can't help but wonder if that's been your discipleship. If there's no room for the crucifixion in our lives, I can guarantee you there's no room for the resurrection. And that's the culture, because that's the culture of the gospel, that's the culture of discipleship. We see the faith of Jesus in all of these passages woven into the faith of the disciples. Before we dive into the passage, I just want to ask you, is your way of Jesus deciding the process? Is it deciding the process? Do you maximize the life of Jesus? Maximize the teachings of Jesus? Do you maximize the miracles of Jesus? Perhaps you minimize the significance and necessity of the crucifixion of Jesus. I think it's easy for all of us to be prone towards following Jesus that's really just like our personality. Have you heard about that? Like, I remember being in the Bible study one time, not in this church, but other churches, where there was this moment where they were talking about a big crowd, and this one person was like, how did the world of Jesus say? Like, how did every thousand people? Right, there's no way Jesus could have heard him because Jesus wasn't very outspoken. He was a soft-spoken person. And after the Bible says that that person was like a very introverted person. And then this other person was like, no, Jesus was a loudmouth. Jesus was so loud, he had a big mouth, he could talk to everybody. And somebody was like, that person was an introverted person. It's like, and both of them were just thinking of their own, like, putting Jesus in their cell. Like, Jesus was just like a whole perfect version of them.
Yeah.
And so we put Jesus into our own image, and today what we see is like all of us are tempted to avoid pain as human beings. We're tempted to push away from pain, and yet we can't push the cross out of our Christianity. We just can't. It's unavoidable. So if you lose Christ, you can push out the cross. And so Christ without a cross is discipleship without self-denial. It's discipleship without service. Discipleship without sacrifice. And ironically, when you take out sacrifice and service and submission and self-denial, you take out life. Ironically. Because that's the way of Jesus. The way of Jesus is to die and live. There's no resurrection. Perhaps this morning, for you, there's just too much of your own life. That's still too much of you that needs to die. Too much of you that needs to submit to the reality of Jesus. You're simply staying in your own way of life, your own way of hope, your own way of joy, your own way of passion. And my hope and prayer this morning is that all of us in this room will die. Every single one of us will die. Whatever is hindering God's kingdom in and through us, I pray it will die. And this is where Jesus forces us in this passage in Mark 8. In Mark 8, verse 31, he says that he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer. It's divine necessity. I must suffer. It's no way around it. To be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, the scribes, and be killed. And after 3 days, rise again. And he said this plainly. He said this plainly. And then Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. He's like, Jesus, let me give you some PR advice. Like, that was that thing that happened. You know, like, you know, like, you're in charge, you're Messiah, like, you're the Son of God, and that thing is happening to you, and he begins to rebuke Jesus. And Jesus, turning and seeing his disciples, appears and said, "Get behind me, Satan." That's not a compliment in the Bible. For you are not set in mind on the things of God, but on the things of the man. Right? So Jesus here, he's talking about the necessity of death. And now all throughout this passage, Mark 8, 9, 10, uses on the way, like 5 times. And it's meant to be like geographical and metaphorical, but there's this way of following Jesus. Your discipleship hinges on your understanding of death and resurrection in your life. And Jesus has reached peak popularity here. People are attracted to him. And this is the hinge in Mark. Mark 8 is the hinge of the whole book of Mark 1 through 16. And it's this hinge from this point on, Jesus and his disciples geographically and within himself. And ironically and figuratively, everything else is within himself as well. So Jesus believes this. He believes the crucifixion and resurrection for his disciples. That this way of him, the way of Jesus, that is actually the best thing for his disciples. That crucifixion and resurrection is what is the best for his disciples. So the way of the cross is the way of the cross. As we just saw, it says, "I must go." So we can't separate Jesus from the cross. The cross shapes who we are. It shapes who we are. It informs our worship. It informs the way we live. It informs our paradigm and power in our salvation. And Peter begins to smell what Jesus. At first, before this, it's all been like weird, cryptic stuff. Jesus is like, "Destroy that temple, and I'll raise it again." He's like, "What are you talking about?" He's always saying, like, "I will be able to come like the serpent in numbers." And he's like, "What are you talking about?" And now he says, "Listen, I'm just telling you straight, I'm going to die. And I'm not going to say that." And so for them, this just radical shift, their shift in their paradigm. And Peter is like, "That's not happening to you." Here, and Jesus has these harsh words for Peter. He says, "Get behind me, Satan." Right? You guys ever catch that one? Wow, that's crazy. Jesus called people a lot of names, by the way. Satan, brood, vipers, brood, sinners, whatever. It's okay, call people names in the right moment. So he was always deconstructing, subverting religion when it was correct. And so what he's doing here is, what he's saying is this: if you think back to Jesus' temptation in the very beginning, Jesus was tempted by Satan to not go to the cross. And Jesus fights him off with the scripture and truth and says that's a lie. And I think Satan knows this. Satan knows that once the cross happens, Satan's lost his power. Satan knows that once the cross happens, he's lost his accusations on you as a believer, that his accusations have ways and strategies are resembling that of Satan. And what he's saying is this, is the idea of salvation without a suffering servant is a satanic weapon. The idea of offering salvation, anything that offers you salvation without the suffering atonement of Jesus, the perfect, spotless lamb that was sacrificed, 100% God, 100% man, completely experienced everything you've gone through yet and never sinned. Without that suffering atonement, any kind of idea of salvation, any ideology of salvation, it comes from the Father of God himself. And then he moves seamlessly, Jesus says, through this. And he says, he begins to now take the way of the cross to the way of the disciples. He says, "If anyone would follow me," verse 34, "if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." And now here, taking his way and now applying to us, he's saying, "The way I'm going to live, what's best for you? What's the best thing for your life?" And he says, "If you deny yourself, take the cross and follow me." Now, I think when we hear this verse for a lot of us, we're kind of like, a couple things can happen. One is like, "I already did that." Right? I just treat denying yourself as this moment in time past where you came to know Jesus for the first time, right? Maybe you're as a Christian camp, or maybe you're part of some youth group, or whatever, right? We treat it like an accessory, right? Deny yourself of all things as an accessory. I got that keychain, I got that t-shirt, I'm good there. I did that. And Jesus is like, no, this is, when he says deny, what he's saying is there's an entry. There's an entryway, denying yourself and taking up the cross. But then there's a continual, ongoing, following him in that same way. And once you deny yourself and take up the cross, we have to follow Jesus now every day in the same way. So the way of Jesus is this mode of being for Christian maturity. So now the power of Jesus is making decisions based off Jesus' ethics, making decisions and behaving according to his way. And so the best way I can illustrate this is the way Mark. Throughout this, he's constantly, like I said, using the word the way on the road. And there's a couple of stories afterwards where he basically tries to illustrate what this looks like. In chapter 8, as we saw, here's what Jesus is saying to his disciples of who he is. Jesus is going to go all the way to the cross. And then this is literary writer. They went on from there and passed through Galilee, and he did not want anyone to know. For he was teaching his disciples, saying to them, some men will be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he is killed, after 3 days he will rise. He was reiterating the same message. But then they did not understand him, and they were afraid to ask him. And they came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, what were you discussing? He asked them, what were you discussing? And Jesus is like, I'm going to die. And they're like talking over to the side. He's like, you guys talk about that. And he's like, no, seriously. He's like, well, we're just kind of hard sitting around. Just wondering who's going to be the greatest. It's so funny. He says, but it's not for all the way they had argued with one another about who was the greatest. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine that? So this is like walking to him. No, I'm the greatest. Like, no, I preached with like other leaders. Like, I prayed for 3 people. And I was like, well, I served at 8 a.m. I got up at 8 a.m. I was serving all the time. I hadn't been for the first time that last week. I'm like, yeah, but could you imagine? It's like, this is silly. This is crazy. And he sat and called 12. He said to them, if anyone will be first, he must be the last and the servant of all. And then he took a child, put him in the midst of them, and taking him in his arms, he said, who receives one such child in him receives me. Who receives me receives not me, but him who sent me. So what Jesus was doing here is they're doing what we all do. They're struggling for dominance. They're struggling for dominance. And this is a struggle we can't escape. The struggle for dominance is in every relationship until we acknowledge patterns of control. Submission. We jostle for control, submission, and try to find our place in them. We fight internally with ourselves and with others. We think, even though we remind Jesus, you know what he said, who's the most powerful at work? Who is the most successful in our family? Who's the better dresser? Who are arguing with? Like, in our own heads, we're arguing constantly. Who is the greatest? You argue with Roman or Michael Jordan, right? Often the source of tension in our relationships will brought up the tension. The same tension we feel, this need to assert or protect ourselves when we meet someone new. And reveal something about us, the fundamental insecurity of your core being. And every core relationship we have, this need to assert ourselves. To let people know, like, I'm the fun one, right? Like, I'm the charismatic one, you should love me. Like, what do you see? What do you see my Instagram feed? Like, you're gonna love me. What do you see, like, my taste in food? You're gonna love me. You're gonna love me. Or, so we either assert ourselves, or we protect ourselves out of fear of rejecting, being rejected, out of fear of some of the trends we control and the way we live. And the disciples here, their collective insecurity causes them to fight among themselves. And the irony is that Jesus is like, I'm going to die. Jesus is speaking of surrendering his life, and they are speaking of fulfilling their life. You see that? And this is what Jesus is saying, like, on the way to the way of self-denial. Like, as Christians, like, our call is not to create a new self, call isn't even to be yourself. The call is to deny ourselves. And then we will be yourself. That's what Jesus is saying. Then we will be fulfilled. That your identity is not in these things. And then Jesus speaks. He calls a kid, a child. And notice he doesn't condemn the desire to be great. He just uses it pretty good. He turns it on his head. He's like, you really want to be great? Then you need to be a servant of all. And he redefines greatness. And he takes this child, he puts it up the child on his lap, and he says, whoever welcomes one of these little children, and my name welcomes me. The one who welcomes me, welcomes not just me, but the one who sent me. And in this society, children were regarded as an inconvenience. And I think most of you can understand that, right? As parents. As we go to a restaurant, we just tell people, you're an inconvenience tonight. Pretty bad. Right? Have you felt that before? And on either side of the conversation. Children, like, if you think about it, they don't offer a lot back. Like, they consume resources. They don't really pull their weight back then, they don't know. They had no rights, no status. They were seen as a drain on resources until they were able to come back. Now, why would Jesus grab a kid and say, wouldn't it be great to receive a child? Why would he do that? This is where I should say, like, sign up for the kids' ministry. Volunteer. Jesus is not saying receive a child because they're cute. He's not saying receive a child because they're cuddly. That's not what he's saying. He's saying, receive a child because it's a beautiful sacrifice. That's what he's saying. He's saying, receive a child because it's a service. This is what having kids is. You feed them, you train them, you pray for them. You don't expect them to go back and say, Mom, Dad, this is totally going to help your career. Mom, Dad, this is going to make you like have a greater social life. You're going to save money. You're going to take more vacation. Well, that's me. You don't expect them to say that, right? You know that this is a sacrifice. That's beautiful thing. And this is perfect analogy, but the way we serve, we don't do it for recognition. We don't do it for recognition. We pour into a child. It's sacrificial service. It's just like this. This idea of grace is serving people who can give you nothing in return. It's doing something and not letting anybody know about it. It's becoming the least in the kingdom of this world and great in the kingdom of heaven. Greatness in this way is service and sacrifice for our. So this is what Jesus is saying. This is the crucible life. And he's going to give some, go on at least and ask us to this crucible life. This is the description of the crucible life here. He says this in verse 35. Whoever will save his life will lose it. So if you want to save your life now, this earth, you're going to lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake, will save it. For what does it profit me to gain the whole world? We have everything. This whole world, and you'll lose your soul. For what can a man give in return for his soul? So here he's using this word life, it's the Greek word for psyche. It's that sense of self that makes you unique, that makes you valuable. That sense of self, he says, that you pursue, that makes you unique and valuable. This is actually need to take up your cross and deny that sense of self. We're not talking about denying something to yourself, right? This is something much more substantial than like earning them saying, like, I'm going to deny a child. That's not what Jesus is saying. He's saying something so much more substantial. He's saying deny yourself by denying all of you. And in our day and culture, that's the total opposite of our messaging. Today, if you can summarize the cultural messages you receive every day, is this: you can have it all. You can have it all. Like, there was and it was this lady who just loved all the different hotels. She just didn't want to. And so, and in the end, the very end of the tagline is like, finally, like loyalty program, which you don't have to be loyal to. Do you see that? Like, that's what we want. Like, we want to like be loyal, but not be loyal. Like, we don't want to actually have to be loyal to anyone. But yet, we want to be like, be loyal. And so, it's this picture, and it goes all the way back to Adam and Eve. You can become a person, and you can be like God. You can have this unique identity and form your identity on this thing But what Jesus is saying here is like, if you want to have life, you need to lose your life now. And then he says you have an indestructible. In Christ, you have an indestructible identity, an identity that cannot be touched or destroyed, a new identity. He says, what does it profit a man, verse 36? What does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? For what can a man give in return for his soul? The answer is nothing. He says, die to your fallen identity and be swept up with a new, resurrected identity. Shift from an identity that's built on what you do and how will you do it to an identity of what Christ has done and how well he did. It's just, I know you know this, but it's just a good reminder, right? You are not. You are not your career. You are not your marriage, your relationship status. You are not your sexual fulfillment or lack thereof. You're not just a parent. So all these things, all these identities are going to die. I know because death is bad for thousands. And the only identity that is indestructible in this earth, in this life, is the identity that you are a new child. God, you are a son and daughter of God, and you are His. You belong to Him, and He wants to give you life, and life everlasting to the fullest. That's the only identity that is indestructible. Every other identity we put our faith in, our hope in, our time and energy is going to fail you, or you are going to fail it. Promise. This is the indestructible identity that Jesus says that I must die by false sense of self. Lived to him. There's a guy named John Patton who sent Jesus leading him to tell the gospel to, as a missionary to a group of people on an island who were cannibalistic. And every outsider found themselves in these islands working with him. They were missionaries, who just people who really worked there. They were warrior. The cannibals would eat the outsiders. And Patton said, Jesus is leading me to love these people. Many people protest and says, don't go, I can't eat you, I'm going to die. Don't do that. Many of us would have said the same thing. Pat responded and says, you know, I'm already dead. You can't kill a dead man. I'm already dead. You can't kill a dead man. I've died to my false sense of self. I'm dead to that which the world thinks you should preserve. And when he died to that, he entrusted himself entirely to God, and he risked everything. To love, and when you find yourself with an indestructible identity, all of a sudden now you have an other oriented posture to love. When you have an indestructible identity, you can have an other oriented posture to love, and you can assume an other oriented posture, and you can love them for the sake of it. You can love them without any kind of consumeristic fashion, and you love them in a way that contributes to their glory, their joy, their hope, whether you benefit from them. That is what Jesus has come to do in this road to self-denial. Indestructible identity is the utmost of posture. And then lastly, he ends with this very hard verse to swallow. It says, forever, whoever is ashamed of me, my words, and this adulterous and gender itself, a simple generation. It says, if you're ashamed of me, which muscles have hands, why would you be ashamed of Jesus? But then Jesus uses this other idea that makes us want to shrivel up. This idea that Jesus may be ashamed of certain people. He says, the Son of Man will also be ashamed. If you're ashamed of me, the Son of Man will be ashamed. And he comes in the glory of his Father and the Holy Ghost. Notice the challenge. He says, whoever is ashamed of me, and it makes this concrete, he takes it in an earthly direction. Because we can talk about self-denial and that in very abstract, glorious terms, and we can forget that there may be things about Jesus' way of life. May be ashamed of. Our temptation is to be ashamed of Jesus. Usually when we get into his words, did you notice this? He didn't just say, I'd be ashamed of me, because I think Jesus has a lot of admirers, not a lot of followers. That's pretty easy. But did you notice this? He says, for whoever is ashamed of me in my words, he has it in there on purpose. It becomes very tangible. It's not being ashamed of his words, not being ashamed of his teaching, not being ashamed of what he says. It's that God's way of
God and gospel and kingdom and salvation. It's like he wants us to honor him in his teaching. How do we do that? We do that by prosperity. We do that by submission. We do that by sacrifice, self-denial, and obedience. And what's here is there's a flip to that as well. There's a flip to that that doesn't just mean he's going to be ashamed of people. It means he's going to honor people. It means that he's going to give an honor that's incomparable to any other honor. The opposite of shame is honor. I don't know if you think about this, but we are moving more of a shame honor culture. That's basically what social media is there for, is to provide an alternative to shame and honor. And because we move more into this old school, ancient honor shame culture, this hits a lot of our minds with us. That Jesus, he honors those who honor him. His creator of the universe is going to honor him. Isn't that beautiful? That the way of the Father honored his Son, he said, I want to honor you the same way. There's an honor to everyone who trusts in Jesus. And the way the Father honored Jesus, he said, this is my beloved Son, my Lord. So you, every single one of you, who follow Jesus, and you live this life of self-denial. And I just want to tell you, when you do that, I personally feel so much encouragement. When you live a life of self-denial, my heart honors you. My heart just goes out to you to know that it fuels me to know that I can continue on the way of Jesus. That your suffering, your loneliness for following Jesus, and your difficulty for following Jesus, it is a kiss from Jesus because he meets you in the cross. He meets you on the cross, your cross-shaped life, your crucified life. So for those that are in the room of self-denial right now, you're on that road, you're fighting every day, I just want to tell you that God honors you. He honors you. This is my son, this is my daughter, I'm going to please you. He gives you an incomparable honor that is greater than any other honor. When you follow him, you can honor yourself. It's an honor that cannot be matched by any resource in this world, and that liberates you. It liberates you to be radically free and radically loved. When you're radically loved with that kind of honor, that incomparable honor, you're radically free from every false identity. You're radically free to deny yourself, to deny your desires to be self-fulfilled. You're radically free to then move into sacrificial love. I just want to close with this quote. As C.S. Lewis says this about this passage, he says it in his submit to death, death of your ambitions, and favorite wishes, every day the death of your whole body. In the end, submit with every fiber of your being, and you will find eternal life. Keep back nothing. Nothing that you have not given away will be really yours. Nothing in you that has not died will ever be raised from the dead. Look to Christ and you will find him, and with him, everything else will. But Jesus is looking for it. I believe he honors is a life that's filled with a thousand deaths that leads to one beautifully raised life. God, we thank you so much that you don't leave us to ourselves. We know that we are all our own worst enemy. That if we, this morning I pray that every man, woman, and child would say, I want to take a look in the mirror. And I need to submit and make a change. There's an area of your life where you're just going to give them a brand. There's something in your life where you God's calling you to deny yourself, to die to yourself. power of your Spirit upon you. Because we cannot do this on our own. If you will, if you do this on your own strength, you're going to go out of here. Because if you do this on your own strength, you are going to work in it. Yes, ma'am.